Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you for joining me today for readings of interest to the Jewish community. My name is Michael Wolin. The first thing I want to talk about today is this program is undergoing a name change. In the future, we will be known as Jewish Popery. Now, popery is not a common word, but what it means is a collection, an assortment, a pastiche, that kind of sense, a smorgasbord, that kind of meaning, to better reflect what the content of this program is. It's not really a news program, or not strictly a news program, but it's something that deals with many different aspects of all kinds of subjects, anything that's really of interest to the Jewish community. So while we're still readings of interest to the Jewish community, it's not a news program, which is how it was defined before. So there's a change, and also it makes it a little easier to find on the website. If you do a search, can't find the program for one reason or another, if you just do a search on Popery or Jewish, you'll find this program. Let's start with a Dvar Torah, words from the Torah. Today, from Rabbi Yonatan Sacks of blessed memory. And he is commenting on the first verse, that is the first portion, Parsha, in the book of Vayikra. And it's Parsha Vayikra. He titles this The Dimensions of Sin, and it's really quite an involved but a very interesting way of reasoning and of thinking to do with sacrifice for the most part. That's what he's going to be talking about. The English for this book is Leviticus. We are in the book of Leviticus, the third book of the Torah. This Parsha, which deals with a variety of sacrifices, devotes an extended section to the chatat, the sin offering, as brought by different individuals. First, the high priest, which is in our Parsha, chapter 4, verses 3 through 12. Then, the community, chapters 13 through 21. Then, a leader, chapters 21 through 26, and finally just an ordinary individual, chapters 27 through 35. Now, this is a lot of text given over to this. Clearly, there's something that they want to say. The whole passage sounds strange to modern ears, not only because sacrifices have not been offered for almost two millennia since the destruction of the Second Temple, but also because it is hard for us to understand the very concepts of sin and atonement as they are dealt with in the Torah. The puzzle is that the sins for which an offering had to be brought were those committed inadvertently. The Hebrew is be-shogeg. Either the sinner had forgotten the law or some relevant fact. So, a contemporary example, suppose the phone rings on the Sabbath, on Shabbat, and you answer it. You would only be liable for a sin offering if either you forgot the law, that you may not answer a phone on Shabbat, or you forgot the fact that the day was Shabbat. If for a moment you thought it was Friday or Sunday or another day, so your sin was inadvertent. This is the kind of act we don't intend to see as a sin at all. It's not a sin. It's a mistake. You forgot. You did not mean to do anything wrong. And when you realize that, inadvertently, you have broken the Sabbath, you are more likely to feel regret than remorse. You feel sorry for what you've done, but you don't feel guilty. We think of a sin as something we did intentionally, yielding to temptation perhaps, or in a moment of rebellion. That is what Jewish law calls Beit Zadon in Biblical Hebrew, or Beit Metzid in Rabbinic Hebrew. This is the kind of act we would have thought calls for a sin offering. But actually, such an act cannot be atoned for by an offering at all. So, how are we to make sense of the sin offering? The answer is that there are three dimensions of wrongdoing between us and God. The first is guilt and shame. When we sin deliberately and intentionally, we know inwardly that we have done wrong. Our conscience, the voice of God within the human heart, tells us that we have done wrong. This is what happened to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden after they had sinned. They felt shame. They tried to hide. For that kind of deliberate, conscious, intentional sin, the only adequate moral response is tshuva, repentance. This involves A. remorse, charata, B. confession, vidui, and C. kabbalat le'atid, a resolution never to commit the sin again. The result is slicha u'mechila, God forgives us. A mere sacrifice is not enough. However, there is a second dimension. Regardless of guilt and responsibility, if we commit a sin, we have objectively transgressed a boundary. The word chet means to miss the mark, to stray, to deviate from the proper path. We have committed an act that somehow disturbs the moral balance of the world. To take another secular example, imagine your car has a defective speedometer. You are caught driving 50 miles an hour in a 30 mile an hour zone. You tell the policeman who stops you that you didn't know your speedometer was only showing 30 miles an hour. He may sympathize, but you have still broken the law. You have transgressed the speed limit, albeit unknowingly, and you will have to pay the penalty. That is what a sin offering is. According to Rabbi Shimshon Raphael Hirsch, it is a penalty for carelessness. According to the Sefer HaChinuch, it is an educational and preventative measure. Deeds, in Judaism, are the way we train the mind. The fact that you have had to pay the price by bringing a sacrifice will make you take greater care in the future. Rabbi Isaac Arama, who lived in Spain in the 15th century, says that the difference between an intentional and an unintentional sin is that in the former case, both the body and the soul were at fault. In the case of an unintentional sin, only the body was at fault, not the soul. Therefore, a physical sacrifice helps, since it was only the physical act of the body that was in the wrong. A physical sacrifice cannot atone for a deliberate sin, because it cannot rectify a wrong in the soul. What the sacrifice achieves is kapara, not forgiveness as such, but a covering over or an obliteration of the sin. Noach was told to cover. The verb was ve'chaparta, the surface of the ark with pitch. This is in Genesis chapter 6, verse 14. The cover of the ark in the tabernacle was called kaparet. Once again from our parsha, Leviticus chapter 25, verse 17. Once a sin has been symbolically covered over, it is forgiven. But as the Malbim points out, in such cases the verb for forgiveness, the S, the L, the CH sound, S, L, CH, or a CH sound, is always in the passive. The forgiveness is not direct, as is in the case of repentance, but indirect, a consequence of the sacrifice. The third dimension of sin is that it defiles. It leaves a stain on your character. Isaiah, in the presence of God, feels that he has unclean lips. That's his language, unclean lips. sometimes translated as uncircumcised lips. This is from Isaiah chapter 6, verse 5. King David says to God, "Wash me thoroughly from my iniquity and cleanse me from my sin." The Hebrew is me chatati tahareni. This is in Psalms chapter 51, verse 4. Psalm 51, verse 4. And about Yom Kippur, the Torah says, "On that day, atonement will be made for you to cleanse you, letaher etchem. Then before the Lord you will be clean from all your sins." Leviticus, our Parsha, chapter 16, verse 30. Remember that this is the logic of the sin offering. All sins, even those committed inadvertently, have consequences. They each leave a stain on the soul and constitute a blemish on it, and the soul is only fit to meet its Maker when it has been cleansed from all sin. The result of the sin offering is tehora, cleansing, purification. So the sin offering is not about guilt, but about other dimensions of transgression. It is one of the stranger features of Western civilization, due in part to Pauline Christianity, and partly to the influence of the philosopher Immanuel Kant, that we tend to think about morality and spirituality as matters almost exclusively to do with the mind and its motives. But our acts leave traces in the world, and even unintentional sins can leave us feeling defiled. The law of the sin offering reminds us that we can do harm unintentionally, and this can have psychological consequences. The best way of putting things right is to make a sacrifice, to do something that costs us something. In ancient times, that took the form of a sacrifice offered on the altar of the temple. Nowadays, the best way of doing so is to give money to charity, tzedakah, or to perform an act of kindness to others, chesed. The prophet said so long ago in God's name. Quote, "For I desire loving kindness, not sacrifice." That's from Hosea chapter 6, verse 6. Charity and kindness are our substitutes for sacrifice, and, like the sin offering of old, they help mend what is broken in the world and in our soul. Well, there you have Rabbi Yonatan Sacks commenting on this week's Parsha, Vayikra, from the book of Leviticus. Well, Purim is just around the corner. And Purim is a festive holiday. So let's talk a little bit about Purim. Now, it's hard to be festive in the shadow of things like October 7. But that's something that we're supposed to do. So one question is, how do you do that? And what is that all about? Here's another article by Rabbi Sacks. He titles this, "The Therapeutic Joy of Purim." He says there's something very strange about Purim. It is notably a festival of joy. Yamei Mishte Basimcha. And not only is the day itself a joyous one, but uniquely, we begin that joy 2 weeks beforehand. Mishech Nichas Adar Marbim Basimcha means that from the very beginning of Adar, we begin to increase our joy. And it is not only in the weeks leading up to Purim. This joy is present throughout the year. Every Motzei Shabbat, during the Havdalah service, we remind ourselves of that line from the Megillah. Le-Yehudim hayta ora v'simcha, meaning, for Jews there was light and joy. Yet, what exactly are we celebrating on Purim? The mere fact that we survived? That Haman's decree of genocide was not enacted? That the evil decree, leharog u lehabed u lehashmid, to kill, destroy, and exterminate every single Jew, young and old, men and women, on a single day, was averted? This is not a cause for joy. It is a cause for great relief. That is not a cause for celebration, but really for post-traumatic stress disorder. So the question I'm presenting here is, what is this unique joy of Purim? Well, I'd like to propose, that is, Rabbi Sacks would like to propose the following answer. There are two kinds of joy. There is expressive joy, the joy you experience and communicate because that's how you feel. But there is also therapeutic joy, the joy you will yourself to feel in order to protect yourself against negative emotions. And when we rejoice on Purim, on this festival, which is actually the festival about anti-Semitism, we are saying something very important. We will not be intimidated. We will not be traumatized. We will not be defined by our enemies. We will live with the threats and even laugh at them, because what we can laugh at, we cannot be held captive by. And that, therefore, is really what the joy of Purim is about. It is about surviving, and beyond that, thriving, even as we walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It is a way of saying, I will eat, and I will drink, and I will celebrate, and I will not let dark clouds enter my mind or enter my heart. So, therefore, Purim holds a real message for our time. When we have seen anti-Semitism return, we must never let ourselves be intimidated, and that certainly describes the days today. And the Jewish way to avoid this is to be marbim besimcha, to increase our joy, because the people who can know the full darkness of history and yet rejoice is a people whose spirit no power on earth can break. Well, I am reminded of a survey done recently, in the last week or two, of this is a happiness index of countries in the world, and they measured something like 164 of them for how happy they are. Number one on the list for the last, I think, 5 or 6 years was Finland, and other Scandinavian countries, Sweden, Denmark, Norway, were in 1, 2, 3, 4. But number five was a surprise and a mystery. It is Israel. Israel is the fifth happiest country in the world. And you wonder, how can that be? They've just experienced a horrific episode, October 7, a horrible pogrom, and they are at war. And they are continually under assault. They are surrounded by enemies that literally wish them all to be dead. Yet, they are the fifth happiest country in the world. By way of comparison, think about the United States, where we are. We are the 23rd happiest country in the world. Now, just a few years ago, we were the 10th happiest country in the world. So, a lot of unhappiness in the United States. There's many, many respects we need a change of attitude and a change of perspective. In many ways, something that has been accomplished in Israel, the fifth happiest country in the world. Well, let's complete this, just some themes to do with Purim. Here's another one, once again, by Rabbi Sacks. He calls this God's hidden call. He says the sages noted something remarkable about Purim and about the Megillah. They asked, Esther min HaTorah minayin, where can we see a hint of Esther in the Torah? And they're really saying in the Mosaic books. And they answered, Ve'anochi hastir astir et panai. God warns that in future days when the Jews abandon him, I will surely hide my face on that day. The name Esther has the same root as the Hebrew word astir, and that means the hiddenness of God. Words are pretty interesting. Now, the quote from the Torah is God's warning that at certain dark moments in Jewish history, it will seem as if God is not there. And therefore, what the sages were saying by finding this link to the name Esther is profoundly insightful. First of all, the book of Esther is one of only two books in the whole of the Tanakh where the name of God is absent. It is as if God were hiding his face. Secondly, Purim is supremely the festival of diaspora, of galut, of exile, because it is set in Persia, where Jews are a tiny minority and they cannot defend themselves. They cannot fight back. And the only way really they can protect themselves is by shadlanut, that is, behind the scenes of diplomacy. And thirdly, it really is the book in which we come face to face with the first explicit warrant for genocide, Haman's threat to destroy every single Jew on one day. It is a book of the hiding of the face of God. And what the Torah is telling us, what the book of Esther and the festival of Purim are telling us, is that God is still there, even if he seems hidden. He was there giving Mordechai and Esther the courage to fight back. He was there somehow protecting the people from destruction, somehow salvaging redemption. And the book of Esther is therefore a testimony to hope against the odds of God's spirit that lives in the hearts of those who care for their people. That somehow Esther is a promise that Venacha fohu, the situation will be reversed, that there will be an overturning of fate, that this tiny, vulnerable people will outlive, as it has done, every single enemy and every empire that sought its destruction. The book of Esther teaches us the same message that was found written by a Jew, a prisoner during the Holocaust in Cologne, Germany. They wrote a simple, powerful testimony of faith. Quote, I believe in the sun, even when it is not shining. I believe in love, even when I cannot feel it. I believe in God, even when he is silent. That is what the book of Esther is about, telling us that even when God seems to be hiding his face, he is still there, still alive, and still in our hearts. And Rabbi Sachs closes this with a wish, Purim Sameach to you all, a joyous Purim to you all. Well, let's talk a little bit about Queen Esther, a woman of valor. Well, any individual, including us, can have an impact on the powers that be and protect our brethren at home and abroad. This article is by a gentleman, William Daroff, who is the CEO of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. In that capacity, he is a senior professional guiding the conference's agenda on behalf of the 50 national member organizations which represent a wide mosaic of American Jewish life. Jewish holidays have a miraculous way of reminding us that we're not so far removed from the experiences of our ancestors, and that, as they prevailed in their times, so shall we prevail in ours. Purim requires a special resonance this year as a reminder of the precariousness of Jewish existence as a perennial reality, and that each generation must battle the scourge of anti-Semitism. American Jews, who for so long felt largely spared from this constant of Jewish history, now find ourselves faced with a dilemma that would feel familiar to many of our ancestors. How do we combat an evil actor who wants to exterminate the Jews and has sympathizers in our own land, and a lot of them? Queen Esther serves as a timeless example to us. We must summon our courage and raise our voices before the powers that be. Present-day American Jews have privileges not afforded to our ancestors. We have reached the highest echelons of political and social life. We have a loud and authoritative voice on issues that concern us. We have relationships with other diverse communities and those in power. In this time of need, we must recall the words of Mordechai to Esther, who herself hesitated to petition the king to spare her people. Mordechai reminded her, "Who knows if it is not for just such a time that you have reached this royal position? Do not think that you will escape the fate of all the Jews by being in a place of power." Queen Esther heeded his words and saved the Jewish people through her intervention. We too can have an impact on the powers that be and protect our brethren at home and abroad. We too must remember that we are not immunized from the dangers of anti-Semitism, no matter the status we often enjoy as a community. And we too must stand up for other Jews around the world, even if we feel safe within our own homes. Purim is a festive holiday, replete with noisemakers, costumes, and carnivals. Many worry that our merriment is unseemly at such a time as now. How can we be so cheerful amid the loss of the 1,200 innocents murdered October 7? Add to that the ordeal of the over 100 hostages still held in Gaza, and the families of those who have lost loved ones in their battle against Hamas. These are difficult questions indeed, but in Judaism we sanctify life and seek to make it joyful, even amidst the greatest of hardships. We even have historical accounts of Purim being celebrated in the ghettos of Nazi-occupied Europe during the Holocaust. We must find it within ourselves to be cheerful, especially for our children's sake. They must know that to be part of the Jewish people is not only to suffer, but to celebrate our heritage and our many victories also. The Jewish people remain united as ever before, understanding that right now in Gaza, an existential struggle for both the State of Israel and the Jewish people is being waged. The wicked Haimans of Hamas, having successfully carried out a pogrom, should never have the chance to annihilate so many of us again. Queen Esther remains a relevant and inspirational icon this Purim season. May this foremother of us and woman of valor be both a personal and a political model for us. Good words on Queen Esther, a woman of valor, by William Daroff, CEO of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Well, let's move on a little bit here. Talk about something current. Well, what's going on in Gaza is still front and center. Just a few words here about our Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, Jewish man. And this article is by Ruthie Bloom. She is a columnist and former advisor to the Prime Minister's office, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. She calls this Blinken's Rafah blunder. In a press conference Thursday, just passed, in Cairo, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken reiterated his opposition to an Israeli ground operation in Rafah, saying such a move would be a mistake. An invasion into the southern Gaza city, he said, was unnecessary to achieving the goal of defeating Hamas. This attitude, which the Biden administration has been expressing with increasing fervor, runs counter to Israeli assessments. It has become the key bone of contention between Washington and Jerusalem since the start of the October 7 war, spurred by a massacre of Jews that has not been seen since the Holocaust. Other disagreements surrounding the use of force by Israel, civilian Palestinian casualties, and plans for the day after have been mild by comparison, or at least they've been treated by Israel as arguments that can be addressed through a presentation of the facts. This hasn't been simply a tactical ploy to avert discord. To the contrary, the justice of destroying the genocidal terrorist organization that controls territory along Israel's southern border and vows to repeat the atrocities of October 7 again and again and again is irrefutable. Anyone disputing Israel's duty to eradicate Hamas for the survival of the Jewish state, as well as for the benefit of the region and the world, is on the wrong side of history. Period. Furthermore, Israel has the data to support the extreme measures it employs to avoid non-combatant deaths in Gaza. It has proof of the huge quantities of humanitarian aid entering the Strip. More than 250 tons have entered the Strip so far. It also has evidence of its efforts to prevent Hamas from stealing the goods, which has also happened. Blinken is fully aware of all of this. He is equally cognizant that the war would end in an instant if Hamas surrendered unconditionally and released the remaining 134 hostages, among them many United States citizens held in its sadistic, sexually abusive captivity. But since the only pressure Hamas feels or understands is that exerted by the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, bombs, and troops, America's top diplomat has no recourse but to powwow with Qatar and Egypt. The former has close ties with Iran and provides refuge for exiled Hamas bigwigs. They live in luxury in Qatar. The latter, Egypt, shares a border with Gaza. Though porous enough to have enabled the flow of materials for the construction of hundreds of miles of Hamas terror tunnels, it has been totally impenetrable for Gaza residents wanting to leave. Has Blinken raised these issues during his shuttle diplomacy excursions to the Middle East to mediate a deal for the release of the hostages that involves a halt in the fighting? No, of course not. No, as a Jew, that's in quotes, he has been too busy warning Israel about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and pushing for a sustained ceasefire. You know, to persuade Hamas to free the innocent men, women, and children whom it mercilessly abducted from their homes and a neighboring music festival almost a half year ago. The Israeli war cabinet's adamance about going into Rafah to wipe out the last Hamas battalions and locate the hostages is thus especially inconvenient. Hence, Blinken and his boss in the White House are promoting a fantasy as far-fetched as the two-state solution, and nuclear agreement with Iran, that Hamas can be destroyed by other means. Kindness, apparently. Apparently, they think it's possible to win this war without killing any more terrorists or the human shields behind whom they hide. Talk about music to Yahya Sinwar, the Hamas chief. No wonder his ultimate demand is for a full IDF withdrawal from Gaza and continued Hamas reign in the enclave. In other words, business as usual. He doesn't want to agree to a temporary ceasefire in exchange for hostages, or a temporary ceasefire at all. Having done so in November was due to two factors. One was IDF power. The other was the assumption that Israel wouldn't have the wherewithal or the legitimacy to resume fighting. He was right about the first, but wrong about the second. Today, however, thanks to U.S. admonitions about Rafah, Sinwar has cause to up any ante on any offer. It's not clear, then, what Blinken meant by announcing in Saudi Arabia that, and in Egypt the following day, that the gaps are narrowing in the negotiations. Perhaps he can explain how he reached that baseless conclusion when he meets with Prime Minister Netanyahu upcoming Friday in Israel. And that was yesterday as I'm speaking. And Netanyahu would do well to point out how unwise it is, particularly with a new round of talks kicking off in Doha, to make pronouncements that embolden Sinwar and raise false hopes for the desperate families of the hostages. Well, there's many ways that the people that are determining American foreign policy and policy in the Mideast are deluded. And this is just one of them. This would be an open invitation to Hamas to survive, to reform, to regroup, for Israel to accept this and to consider an attack such as happened October 7 to occur another time, and that will be normal. I don't think that will happen. Well, that's considered Blinken's Rafah blunder. Let's see, here's another one we have here. This is a transcript of Rabbi Sacks' broadcast on the BBC, their radio station called Radio 4, Thought for the Day. And this is 22 years ago. We'll see what's changed. This is called Purim and the Longest Hatred. Soon we'll be celebrating the Jewish Festival of Purim. It's a joyous day. We have a festive meal. We send presents to our friends and gifts to the poor, so that no one should feel excluded. Anyone joining us on Purim would think it commemorates one of the great moments in Jewish history, like the Exodus from slavery or the revelation at Mount Sinai. Actually, though, the truth is quite different. Purim is the day we remember the story told in the book of Esther, set in Persia in pre-Christian times, roughly 480 years before the Common Era. It tells of how a senior member of the Persian court, Haman, got angry that one man, Mordechai, refused to bow down to him. Discovering that Mordechai was a Jew, he decided to take revenge on all Jews and persuaded the king to issue a decree that they should all, young and old, men, women, children, be annihilated on a single day. Only the fact that Esther, Mordechai's cousin, was the king's favorite allowed her to intercede on behalf of her people and defeat the plan. Purim is, in other words, the festival of survival in the face of attempted genocide. It wasn't until way into adult life that I realized that what we celebrate on Purim is simply the fact that we're alive, that our ancestors weren't murdered after all. Like many of my generation born after the Holocaust, I thought anti-Semitism was dead, that a hate so irrational, so murderous, had finally been laid to rest. So it has come as a shock to realize in recent months that it is still strong in many parts of the world, and that even in Britain, a cleric appeared in court charged with distributing a tape calling on his followers to, can you guess, to kill Jews. What is it about Jews, or black people, or Roma, or foreigners, that causes them to be hated? The oldest explanation is probably the simplest, because we don't like the unlike. As Haman put it, their customs are different from those of other people, and that's why racial or religious hate isn't just dangerous. It's a betrayal of the human condition. We are different. Every individual, every culture, every ethnicity, every faith gives something unique to humanity. Religious and racial diversity are as essential to our world as biodiversity. And therefore, I pray that we have the courage to fight prejudice, of which anti-Semitism is simply the oldest, perhaps the most vehement of them all. Because a world that can't live with difference is a world that lacks room for humanity itself. And as you might expect from Rabbi Sacks, wise words. That is Purim and the longest hatred. Well, let's move along here. Got another one that I think you'll enjoy hearing. The holiday, or I should say the month, it is a month of Ramadan, is something that is occurring now. We are in the month of the Muslim month of Ramadan, and it is a month of some celebrations. It is a month of prayer, a month of contrition, a month of reflection. And unfortunately, it is a month of violence. This article that I'm reading is from the Jerusalem Post. It's by David Weinberg. And he says, accepting Muslim violence on Ramadan insults the majority of Muslims. Well, what could that mean? He says, it would be nice if Palestinian Muslims in Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, and Gaza would approach Ramadan as intended by their religion, as a month of fasting, charity, prayer, contrition, and reflection. Many devout Muslims do so, but it is especially true that Ramadan frequently has been celebrated with an orgy of Muslim, especially Palestinian, violence. Ramadan is exploited as an excuse for ramped-up holy war against Israel. Those with long memories will remember that Egypt and Syria launched a surprise attack against Israel on Yom Kippur, 1973, during the month of Ramadan. In many Arab circles, it is still called the Ramadan War. Somehow the prayer, contrition, and reflection did not inhibit that sneak attack that slaughtered 2,700 Israelis. Neither did the fasting. Egyptian and Syrian soldiers were given an exemption from fasting because they were engaged in the religious duty of killing infidels, the category that Jews are in. It's not even limited to Jews. In 2016 and 2017, ISIS twice bombed a popular street in Baghdad during Ramadan, killing hundreds of Muslims. During that same 2016 Ramadan, a radical Muslim attacked the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida, murdering 49 people. These are not isolated examples. Arabs have historically fought vicious wars against each other during Ramadan. And, sure enough, again this year, everyone fears escalation, quote, escalation, in Ramadan, especially since Hamas and its mouthpiece, the Al Jazeera Broadcasting Network, are religiously calling for expansion of the Al-Aqsa Flood. That's what they call the current war launched by Hamas October 7, attack. That's what they call that war against Jerusalem. And they appeal to Muslims in Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria to uprise through acts of terror. And so the defense establishment in this country is warning Israeli leaders to pay deference to Ramadan, to be extra cautious during Ramadan, to do nothing to provoke Muslims on Ramadan, especially in and around Jerusalem's Temple Mount, because Muslim emotions are so very sensitive during that month. U.S. President Joe Biden has even gone so far to hint that Israel should halt its war against Hamas in Gaza so that Muslims will have a chance to piously observe Ramadan and supposedly tap into some of that famous Ramadan charitable spirit, leading Hamas to reverently melt towards a magnanimous hostage deal. Halavai, if only. I wish it were to be so. To a Jew and an Israeli, such sentiments sound bizarre. Well, because they are bizarre. As the sage Rabbi Stephen Pruzansky, formerly of Teaneck, New Jersey, now of Modi'in in Israel, brilliantly has written, and this quote, I do not recall ever becoming so agitated over the 10 days of repentance between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur that I felt the urge to run out and attack innocent Gentiles, or even guilty ones, nor have I ever heard of that passion afflicting any Jew. For that matter, it is inconceivable to any Jew, or any normal, moral, right-thinking person to yell, God is great, as a prelude to murdering, raping, marauding, beheading, exploding, stabbing, shooting innocent people for whatever reason. Perhaps good Muslims could use this Ramadan for soul searching and how best to uproot this savage evil from their midst, wrote Pruzansky. Accepting Muslim violence during Ramadan insults the majority of world Muslims. It is the soft bigotry of low expectations that so-called security experts, politicians, diplomats, and statesmen nod their heads and say, well, of course, tensions always run high during Ramadan, and as such, Jews should keep a low profile, because Muslim violence must be anticipated during this holy month. Such a sentiment insults the majority of the world's Muslims, as well as our intelligence. It is the very definition of surrendering to bullies rather than confronting them and vanquishing them. Which leads me to Palestinian-Jordanian impudence and Israeli infirmity in and around the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Look at how the government of Israel was tied into fits this week with urgent consultations on how and whether to impose anti-riot limits on Arab visitors to the two Muslim shrines on the Temple Mount during the holy month of Ramadan. Well, this comes on the background of the threats described already and stepped up Jordanian and Palestinian Authority efforts in the international arena to warn of the dangers of any attempt to unilaterally alter the status quo at the holy site, meaning the Temple Mount, and to reaffirm Jordan's role as custodian of the Islamic and Christian holy sites in Jerusalem. They describe Israeli visits to the Temple Mount and the quiet, unofficial Jewish prayer quorums that sometimes gather there as stormings and violent incursions into Al-Aqsa Mosque and as the Judaization of Jerusalem and its Muslim holy sites. The inversion of truth contained in this above presentation is utterly galling. If anybody has unilaterally, brazenly, and violently changed the status quo on the Temple Mount over the last 25 years, it is radical Palestinian and Islamic actors who have turned the Mount into a base of hostile operations against Israel, instead of protecting it as a zone of prayer and peace. Israel, on the other hand, has acted with utmost restraint in the face of Arab assaults. The Waqf, which is an Islamic trust, and Islamic movement provocateurs have attacked Jewish visitors to the Temple Mount, Jewish worshippers at the Western Wall below the Mount, and Jewish worshippers on their way to the Western Wall. They have attacked Emiratis and Bahrainis praying in Al-Aqsa Mosque because these countries signed the Abraham Accord peace treaties. They have greatly restricted visitation rights to the Holy Mount for all non-Muslims and hijacked the pulpits in the mosque or on the Mount to preach hatred and violence against Israel. The Waqf also has conducted vast illegal construction projects on the Mount and beneath it, willfully destroying centuries of Jewish archaeological treasures. 400 trucks full of archaeological rich rubble were unceremoniously dumped by the Waqf into the Kidron Valley. Thousands of artifacts from the temple periods have been found since in this rubble. Palestinian Authority head Mahmoud Abbas continues to stoke a broad-scale campaign against the authenticity of Israel's historic rights in Jerusalem. In September of 2015, he screeched about filthy Jewish feet that were desecrating holy Islamic and Christian holy sites in Jerusalem. Quote, Al-Aqsa is ours, and so is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. The Holy Sepulchre. They, the Jews, have no right to desecrate them with their filthy feet. We won't allow them to do so, and we will do whatever we can to defend Jerusalem. At the same time, the Palestinian Authority-controlled Waqf has allowed ISIS, Hamas, Islamic Movement, and Turkish flags to fly on the Temple Mount in violation of all understandings, as well as blood-curdling banners with calls to annihilate Israel and the Jewish people. This inflamed and despicable discourse now is being picked up by gullible and some not-so-gullible Western progressives who blabber on about Israel's unprovoked and unacceptable actions on the Temple Mount, Israel's excessive force, and Israel's violations of the status quo. Even well-meaning Western spokespeople, like State Department spokesmen, have fallen victim to the big lie, with mollycoddling mumbo-jumbo about the need for all sides to de-escalate and respect the sanctity and status quo of holy sites in Jerusalem. All sides should de-escalate, status quo, sanctity of holy sites. What in the world are they talking about? There is only one side, the Arab side, that purposefully has escalated the violence in Jerusalem and defiantly defiled the Temple Mount, the Har HaBayit in Hebrew, or what the Muslims call Al-Haram al-Sharif, or the Noble Sanctuary, over the last 25 years. It is the Palestinians who have turned Al-Aqsa and the entire elevated Mount Plaza into an extraterritorial headquarters for the propagation of blood-curdling lies, big lies, about Israel. In fact, Palestinian violence and Islamic exclusivism have become the new Temple Mount status quo. Is this the status quo Western leaders demand that Israel preserve? Alas, the governments of Israel seem to have gone mute in the face of the slanders at the heart of the Palestinian Islamic narrative regarding the Temple Mount and the Jewish presence in Zion. Even now, when Hamas and its allies in Judea and Samaria are at war with Israel, Israeli leaders continually prefer to keep things quiet and restore calm after every wave of Palestinian assault and to swear fealty to a status quo that is long dead. To top it all off, Jordan has the nerve amidst all this to ask Israel for additional water allocations. Even as Jordanian Queen Rania continues to deny and downplay the October 7 attacks, and Prime Minister Bashir al-Qassafneh and Foreign Minister Ayman Safadi lambast Israel with the most vicious anti-Israel rhetoric, Jordan wants an additional 50 million cubic meters of water over and beyond amounts Israel is obligated to provide under the 1994 peace treaty. This is chutzpah par excellence. But hey, in the spirit of Ramadan, what's 50 million cubic meters of water among friends? Well, indeed. The writer of this article is a senior managing fellow at the Misgav Institute for National Security and Zionist Strategy in Jerusalem. These are his own views. And his diplomatic, defense, political, and Jewish world columns over the last 27 years can be found at davidmweinberg.com, and this article is from the Jerusalem Post. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I see we are about out of time, so let me take the moment here to thank you for joining us for readings of interest to the Jewish community, and don't forget our new name, Jewish Popery. And I'd like to remind you, my name is Michael Wolin. I want to wish all of you a good Shabbos, Shabbat Shalom, Shavua Tov, have a good week, and a Chag Pesach Sameach, a joyful, happy Pesach.